When I was looking at the research of employee experience, I came across some shocking data. And the shocking data was how quickly employees leave.
You're listening to the Elevate Podcast, and I'm your host, Robert Glazer. Join me as I talk to world-class performers about how they build their capacity and reach greater heights in leadership, business, and life, and how you can do the same. Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. Our quote for today is from Sam Walton. There is only one boss, the customer. My guest today and friend Joey Coleman is better at keeping customers happy than almost everyone I know. He's an award-winning speaker at both the national and international conferences and competing against New York Times best-selling authors, business leaders, and internet sensations and celebrities. He's also the author of two Wall Street Journal bestsellers, Never Lose a Customer Again, and his latest book, Never Lose an Employee Again. Joey, welcome back to the Elevate Podcast.
Oh, Robert, thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be back. And thanks to everybody who's joining us to listen in for the conversation. I've been really looking forward to it.
All right, we're going to cue the virtual confetti because you are the first three-time guest in the history of the Elevate Podcast.
Woo-hoo! I love it. I feel particularly honored. Hopefully there will be something that I say in this episode that I didn't say in the first two. We'll see.
So I encourage, well, you know, fourth would be a stretch. So, you know, however it goes, probably.
One can hope. Let's go. I got to get another book ready. Come on.
I'd encourage listeners to check out your previous ones. That was episode 13 and episode 190. So we're going to dive deep into your new book. But before we do that, and while we have you, I think we need to tap into some of your older wisdom, which may be repetitive, but You're best known for all your work kind of in customer retention and your wizardry there. I talk to a lot of CEOs. I'm sure you do. Like, we are in a really impossible environment right now where businesses feel like they're just fighting uphill to keep their customers happy. Everyone seems to want more for less. So what strategies like are you seeing, you know, particularly today that work in this kind of more for less? I would like more, but I have less budget environment, which seems to be straining client satisfaction at a lot of organizations.
Yeah, Robert. I mean, I have a ton of empathy for business leaders globally trying to navigate the world we're in today. And I would kind of address this situation and this concern by saying everything has changed and everything is exactly as the same it was before. So what I mean by that is post-pandemic, the expectation that customers have, the expectation that employees have, the expectation that humans have, has completely been rewired. The blueprints that we had before of what was enough, what we would be satisfied with, what our expectations were, what our definition of things like done well, done very well, done in an excellent fashion, have all changed. That being said, what has stayed the same is connecting with people on a personal and emotional level still wins. And in an increasingly digitized world where everybody is working towards least common denominator solutions, how can we automate? How can we systematize? How can we have you interact with some AI or some robot instead of a human? Our drive to do that, what it's really costing us is empathy and human connection and emotion and personality. And that's where I think the best businesses in the world are doubling down into the humanness aspect of their interactions. Because in my experience, Robert, and I imagine you might have had a similar experience, even in a place of conflict with another person, if you can cut to the most human elements of what's happening and show a little empathy, show a little grace, give a little empathy, give a little grace, it seems to solve about 98% of the problems we'd ever come across.
Yeah, I mean, communication's a lot of it. But, you know, you brought up a point, particularly I think AI, like I think it can be a great tool. And unfortunately, I think it is going to be a way for people to not think, not connect, not stand out. We're all going to get 500 perfectly written sales emails every week. The issue is, as I got one last week, hey, Robert, it looks like Friday Ford would be such an awesome customer for our whatever services. And I was like, wow, it's a newsletter. Like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, so no matter how well you write the email, when you send it to people with no context, it sounds ridiculous. So I think these tools are all an opportunity for us to serve clients better, customers better. I'm worried about people using it for scale rather than quality.
Absolutely. And I think until we make it more socially acceptable, especially here in the United States, to have a business that isn't worshiping at the altar of scale at all cost, we're going to have a problem. I've been saying for years, I don't know when lifestyle business became a bad word, but I'd like to know when it did. Like most entrepreneurs I know got into business, not to have a billion customers, but because they wanted to create a life that they enjoyed living. They wanted to provide for their communities. They wanted to solve problems. They wanted to, you know, do interesting things. But we become so fixated on how can we squeeze every penny of possible transaction out of every email address we have. I run into this with my team all the time. I get the pleasure of speaking on stages all over the world. One of the things I do at the end of my talks is I say, hey, I'd love your feedback on what you liked about the speech.
Yeah.
Now, why do I do that? Because I'm a speaker and that's my audience. These are my customers. I want to know what resonated, what didn't resonate. So I get their emails and I send them a single email, the survey. That's all I send them is the survey. Hey, and there's some prizes if you complete the survey. Invariably, whenever I talk to any business consultant, they're like, well, how many emails have you collected doing that? And I'm like, oh my gosh, tens of thousands. And they're like, oh my gosh, we need to start doing a weekly email to all those people. I'm like, absolutely not.
Yeah. You know, like I asked them for their feedback. It wasn't a bait and switch.
I didn't ask them to be on an email. And by the way, why? Well, because if you do that and you do it again and again, week after week, month after month, then when you're ready to sell them something, you can sell it to them. I'm like, why? Because then you can make more money. Why? You know, I just keep asking.
Well, did you see, you might not have seen my Friday Forward. 2 days was on lifestyle businesses last Friday. I don't know if you saw it.
I love it. I missed it. I didn't get a chance to see it. I'm a regular reader, but I was on vacation, so I missed that one.
Yeah, I know. So it was actually predicated on my interview to kick off this new season with David Heinemar Hansen, who founded Basecamp, which is
nice.
You know, he and Jason Fried have railed against the venture community labeling lifestyle businesses pejoratively for years. And they have a pretty good lifestyle and a pretty good business.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So I think it's one of those things where, like you, I remain cautious about what AI and all these additional technology tools are going to actually do to businesses. But I'm not as fear-driven as some of the conversations, in the sense that, you know, when the first computers rolled out, when we went from calculators to desktop computers, that was the end of the world. We were going to suddenly know there were going to be no more jobs and everything. Yeah. And what we actually found is that more people could do work that wasn't backbreaking work, which is kind of I think a net positive for humanity if we can work with our brains, not our backs. Not to saying that there's anything wrong working with our backs, but we can kind of move to different levels. And my hope is that that's what some of the technology is going to free up. It's going to allow us to work more in our creative space, work more in the things that light us up, as opposed to the things that have to be done. Because, like, for example, there are plenty of tasks in my business that not only do I not like to do, it seems like most of my team doesn't like to do either.
Yeah.
So if we can automate some of those, that's a net positive for all of us.
Yeah. But all these require, technology is not a business, and it requires, right? And what also is left out in this AI equation is this computing power and stuff required to make these things work is incredibly expensive. So if you're offering a cool free thing, it's not like you said, set up a $5 website, right? And you don't have a way to get customers to pay for it. Like, there's not free money anymore that led to a lot of the hyper growth. So I don't know that there's an appetite for businesses to lose tons of money right now, which apparently OpenAI is losing almost $1 million a day. And they charge $20 to 1 million people for a subscription.
Well, I think this whole idea, and of course, I've always been more of a love to hang out with the small businesses than the big businesses, because the small businesses have to prove themselves in the marketplace to survive.
Yeah.
The big businesses have to prove themselves in a boardroom with a bunch of VCs to keep getting funding, or in the public markets, selling to institutional investors to keep stock prices up. They can weather these storms.
Yeah. If your scrappy entrepreneur has got to turn a dollar into 10, I've always said, like, I can turn $10 into two. Like, that's, give me $10 and turn $2 of revenue. Yeah,
we've all had that experience.
That's
right.
Hard.
But yeah. No, it's not.
Just open a restaurant, right? That would be the easiest way to do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Easiest way to cut your money, you know, by 80% overnight. Absolutely. And I think what we're actually going to see is more small business. I think we're going to see more boutique businesses. We're going to see more folks. My wife and I were having this conversation the other day. We were staying at a hotel, and this was kind of a mid to upper range hotel, and the experience was just abysmal. I mean, it was absolutely abysmal. We check into this hotel, and I've got my whole family with us. We've been traveling all day. I open the door, and my sense of smell is my worst sense of all the five senses. I open the door and I get blown back by how horrible it is. And I was like, oh my gosh, my wife's like, what's wrong? And I closed the door. I said, we're not spending the night in this room. I don't know what happened in this room, but it is so bad that anybody that would come up here. And I went down to the front desk and I said, hey, I don't know what went on in that room. Can you please switch us to another room? Something's really bad in that room. And the person behind the desk was like, really? And I said, yeah, I don't know what it is. I'm happy to go up there with you if you want, but it's really bad. And it was as if I had asked for a kidney. Yeah. I was like, no, we should have a minimum level of service. And we eventually got into a room that didn't smell like a crime scene. And I said to my wife, I think what's going to happen is we're going to see people moving away from the big brands to go back to the boutique, you know, mom and pop shops, mom and pop hotels, those type of things.
Or where there's personal accountability, right?
Exactly. Where the person behind the desk, and I understand it is hard to find employees. I get that. But when there is no connection between the experience and the service that's being offered, I can pull out a stopwatch and track how much longer you're going to be in business.
Have you ever owned something that inspired you to up your game? 2 years ago, I bought a dual suspension mountain bike for the first time, and it pushed me to ride trails that I had never been willing to try before. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has exceptional capability that will have you seeing the possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. The Lexus GX comes with available dynamic sky panorama glass roof, available front row massaging seats, best-in-class towing capacity, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, and available multi-terrain select. I've seen the new Lexus GX popping up all around my town, and not only does it have the capabilities to take you to new places on and off the road, but it's a great-looking car. The new Lexus GX is ready to raise the bar for you. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. Hey, Elevate listeners. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify is the partner you need to keep the cash register ringing for your e-commerce business. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading platforms. I advise a lot of companies in the e-commerce space, and almost all of them have migrated to Shopify. And as a buyer, what I love about buying from Shopify-enabled sites is that they already know who I am, and I don't have to create a new account or enter all my payment info. The Shop Pay service makes it faster and easier to buy, which surely helps with conversions. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., and Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/elevate. All lowercase. Go to shopify.com/elevate now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/elevate.
Well, with all this tech and stuff, it's encouraging a lot of handoffs, right? Rather than ownership. So this was the Friday Four 2 weeks ago about the United story where the woman called United five times to find her bag and they told her it was one. And she said, I have an AirTag. It's like sitting here in Chicago. And they were like, no, it's not. And they're like, well, can you just look? Like, can someone look? Because it's telling me it's like really. So she bought a ticket, got on a plane, went to Chicago, went with the AirTag. No one from United, after 8 phone calls, could figure out how to get someone to see. And they had tagged the bag wrong, you know, and that's what it turned out. But this is,
of course,
this is what happens when, you know, someone doesn't say like, Joey, like, I'm your guy. I'm your gal. Like, give me your phone number.
Yeah. I'm going to solve this problem. I'm going to fix it. I'm going to help you out.
Yeah. Or call me. I'm going to be your quarterback on this, right? I'm going to own it. Like there's no ownership. It still kills me to this day. You know, I call customer service number. I punch in my phone number, my account. Oh, Mr. Glazer, whatever. We get disconnected. They have my phone number. They have,
yeah.
They don't call you They don't call you back. I don't understand it. I don't understand it.
I totally agree with you. Not only do they not call you back, but God forbid you try to call back and get to that same person that you'll never get. And they're like, I'm sorry, we can't transfer. And I'm like, well, can you at least call up the notes the last person did? Well, it appears they did no notes. And I'm like, okay.
So I just answered all my information for 10 minutes. Why was I doing that?
I did the notes. I did the notes. I was the one queuing things in. How did you not respond? It's the bar for customer experience is lying on the ground. It doesn't take that much to do something remarkable that people will talk about.
Yeah. And the problem is, it become over process driven. You stop focusing on the outcomes or the empathy or the, like, again, this person, you know, like, I don't have a protocol, but like, let me figure out how to get someone to take a picture of the bag where the air tag is and see if it's the bag, right? Like
100%. 100%. Yeah. And the crazy thing is, if little things like this aren't working, what about the big things where we're in trouble?
Right.
You know, the organ transplant that gets misplaced, the, you know, the blood test that gets mislabeled, and suddenly somebody's getting a diagnosis or getting treatment that has nothing to do with them. I mean, to your point, the lack of personal accountability and responsibility, which I think often gets pushed as you need to be more responsible, as opposed to an invitation to play at a higher level. An invitation to say, we have a higher standard. If you're coming to work here, this is the standard, not only with which we expect you to treat customers, but which we, your employer, are going to treat you as employees. That's when you start to see the shift, because you can't ask your team to deliver a remarkable customer experience if they have no context for what one is. And therein lies the rub.
Yeah. And this bridges to where your work has gone over the last couple of years, kind of moving from not leaving, but from, in, you know, these go hand in hand, from customer engagement to employee engagement. I know, like, this is what your new book's about. So what caused that shift in focus? Did you find that these two things were inextricably intertwined? Like, can you not get a team to focus on customers if they can't, aren't engaged with themselves?
Well, it's interesting. A couple things. You're right. I'd been in the customer experience space for about 20 plus years now. And I had been in this space for about all of 5 minutes before I realized that you can't have a great customer experience unless you have amazing employees to deliver that experience. The problem, which I frankly recognized then and still is the case today, is that in most organizations, customer experience is the purview of customer service, maybe account management. If you're really progressive, marketing and sales get a little in on it as well. Whereas employee experience is the sole purview of the HR department. And with all due respect to my friends in HR, no one ever got excited when somebody said, well, we're going to invite HR to join us for this meeting, right? That this is a recipe for everybody getting really anxious. And do I need to lawyer up now? And so as a result, in most organizations, not only do we have silos, but we almost have a foreign country that is HR trying to jump in and drop in and do things that the rest of the organization seems to pay very little attention to and give very little care to. And if you doubt the validity of that statement, I ask you just to consider the typical organizational hierarchy. We have a CEO, we have a CFO, we often have a chief sales officer, a chief revenue officer, a chief technology officer.
Yeah, no CPO. Yeah.
There's no CPO. In most organizations. Now, some places are finally moving to CHRO, which is a healthy way of saying chief human resources, you know, officer, which also it's like, folks, it needs to be about people. They're not resources. They are people, right? It's like when people say, oh, my staff. A staff is a stick that you use on a hike. Okay. It's not a human.
Right. We never step back to think about what does human resources mean? I mean, that just is a very strange statement.
Yeah. I mean, the very fundamental language is problematic. So yeah, long story short, I felt now that we had the first book come out, Never Lose a Customer Again, 5 years ago, it was time to address the other side of the coin. The employee experience, because employee experience and customer experience being two sides of the same coin, as you polish one side, the value of the other improves, right? Happier customers, happier employers. More engaged employees leads to better experiences for the customers. They feed on each other in a very symbiotic way.
Well, this is like, if your mental health's good, you certainly are not in a position, or bad, you're not in a position to help other people, right? You're not... you're not even there. So you work, as you said, you work with a lot of small businesses. I think entrepreneurs, maybe preference for these businesses. You know, you talked about, and I sort of chuckled, you know, in the context early in the book, the why don't people care as much as me?
So true. Yeah. This is kind of the proverbial statement I hear from business leaders globally.
Who have 100% of the equity.
Exactly. They're like, oh, I just wish my employees cared as much about the business as I do. Yeah. And I'm like, I understand that. I want to begin from a place of empathy. I am a business owner. I've been a business owner for 20 plus years. I have felt that. I have said that. I have thought that. I'm not proud of that, but that has been the reality.
Yeah.
But what I've come to realize is your people, your team, wishes you cared as much about them as you care about the business. Now, here's the kicker, Robert. I know from all of the conversations I've had with business leaders on all seven continents, they really care about their people. They spend time at night thinking like, oh my gosh, how am I going to make payroll? What am I going to do? I got to devote some time to this. Oh, so-and-so's expecting. They're going to be out on maternity leave. What are we going to do to kind of shore up and keep things going while we're there, but still have a space for them to come back, you know, post-birth? The problem is, I think we over-index on the tell instead of the show. Mm-hmm. So the proverbial kindergarten exercise, show and tell, humans need to have you not only say that they matter, but show them that they matter. And I think that's where we have, especially in the last 50 years in the corporate world, completely fallen apart. We give a lot of lip service to how much, you know, wellness and team building and morale matter, but then we do all of these behaviors that are completely contrary to any of those outcomes, and then act surprised when employees are not thrilled to show up at work.
But is there something in that too, where again, if you're like, look, I'm running a business and I own 100% of the equity and 100% of the profits go to me, like, is it hard to sort of get other people excited about making you more money?
I think it is, but I do think, I'm not saying you have to give up equity, although that's certainly a smart way for somebody to look at it.
Or making sure that they understand what's in it for them, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. What I think the typical employee needs to understand, I had a conversation years ago with a new hire, and she started working for me, and 2 weeks into the job, she said, I'd like to get a meeting on your schedule. I said, okay, let's schedule a time to meet. And she said, yeah, I want to talk about a raise. And I was like, okay, literally 2 weeks into the job. So we come into the meeting and she says, I'd like a raise. And I just kind of smiled. And thankfully, I had been around the block, you know, more than once. And I was like, Joey, say, you know, whoopsah, just lean into this moment. Don't be shocked immediately. Just kind of lean. And I said, okay, why are you looking for a raise? And she said, well, my student loans are starting to come due and they're more expensive than I thought they were going to be. So I need more money. I said, okay, great. I said, do you know how much money you get now? How much money I spend on you now? And she said, well, yeah, every Friday I take home this amount of money. So times 52 is this amount. I said, okay, great. Let's unwind this. Let's do a little business education. By the way, it's not times 52 because you get 2 weeks paid vacation. So it's times 50. And those other 2 weeks, I have to pay all that same amount of money, even though you don't do anything. And she goes, oh, I never really thought about it that way. I said, let me also talk to you about something called taxes. Yeah. And she's like, I know. I can't believe my taxes are being withheld from my paychecks. I was like, I know. Guess what else? I'm paying additional on top of that that you never see. She's like, wait, you're paying my taxes? I'm like, yes, I'm paying payroll taxes and I'm paying things for you. I said, let's talk about your desk, the computer, the lights, all the things we're doing. And when we were, your healthcare, like she hadn't even factored in the healthcare. And I was like, your healthcare is $1,000 a month.
It's a very U.S. unique thing.
Very U.S. unique thing.
Companies
right?
with that, right?
But had no idea what to do. And when we were all done and she finally realized just how much I was paying to have her on the team, I was thrilled because she actually said, you're already paying me more than I was going to ask for, aren't you? I said, yes, I am. She said, okay. So a better way for this would be if I figured out a way for us to make more money. If I did that, could I potentially have a piece of that? I said, 100%. Now we're having the conversation that should have been the lead-in conversation. But what I realized, Robert, in that point is so many kids, and I say kids young workers have no context for what it's like to run a business. And why would they? So many employees have no context for how to run a business. And a lot of employers are guilty of not letting them in. A lot of employers are guilty of not showing the books, not explaining what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, that's why the Great Game of Business, the open book, all that stuff. I think it's also been distorted in the last 10 years of sort of this venture equity, free equity, there's only upside. Historically, if you knew business owners, you know, and there was so much money, you knew people who went under, whose family was wiped out, who, like, I know a lot of people who've sold their businesses and made their employees decided to go above and beyond to give their employees part of that. I still don't know anyone who's ever businesses gone under and the employees chipped in for them, right? So yeah. We see the winning sides of the risk. We don't see that a lot of people have put their house and their family and a lot of things on the line. And look, that's their choice, you know, nothing there. But I think the last 10 years have really obfuscated that. You are seeing businesses fail now. You are seeing people take personal recourse. Money was so cheap for so long that you could almost push the bubble, you know, push it down the road to get out of any of that trouble. And someone, good friend, was telling me a story last night about a thing that's coming up where, you know, their investors need to take the hit or the family needs to kind of take the hit. And you just haven't heard a lot of these in a while. So I think that has distorted the view of, again, running a business that is just upside and that equity is this Silicon Valley stuff that you get that's free. I'm sure you've had this discussion at some point where people say, oh, I want equity, you know, in the business years ago. Oh, okay, well, do you want that sort of upside only equity? Or do you want that equity where you're proportionally, you know, on the hook for the $2 million loan that the business has? And if we need more money, you have to write a check. And inevitably it's, I don't want that equity. So
right. It's like, oh, so you want a different, or you want the equity, so let's switch to pure commission on your salary. No, I still want my salary. Oh, okay. So by the way, I don't have a salary as the business owner. The salary I have is minimal compared to your salary because I'm rolling the dice. I'm rolling the dice on the equity that may or may not pay off. And let's be honest, statistically, doesn't pay off more than it does. I had a friend who just sold his business after 20 years. After everything was done, when he moved all the equity around to the various employees, that he cleared about $1.2 million. Now, I'm not saying $1.2 million isn't a good amount of money.
Yeah.
But what I am saying is, I know for a fact this guy went years paying himself below the poverty line to get to an exit point where it's like, was it all worth it? I'm not saying it was or it wasn't. But I am saying I'd be willing to bet the majority of his employees thought the exit gave him a lot more zeros than it actually did.
Yeah. So one of the things where when I saw it, I was like, oh, totally makes sense. I didn't really think about it. I mean, you talk about in your first book how important this has been your speech, 90 days, customers, 90 days, right? So it shouldn't have been a surprise to me. And look, we remember, I really loved Dan Pink's book, When, you know, one of the things he focused on was, you know, we disproportionately remember beginnings and ends. Like if you're going to have an event, correct, you need an awesome opening and an awesome close. The speakers in the middle, yep, can suck. That's when you can hire me.
And primacy and latency theory, right?
Right. You should open with Joey or close with Joey. So how much does the employee's first 90 days like correlate with their entire experience from what you've assessed?
Yeah. So when I was looking at the research of employee experience, I came across some shocking data. And the shocking data was how quickly employees leave. So across all industries globally, about 40% of new hires quit before the 1 year anniversary. So 40% of the people you're going to hire aren't going to be there for the 1 year anniversary.
And by the way, they probably weren't productive until month 3 to 6, right?
Oh, yeah. Of course not. They weren't productive and you were paying them all kinds of money and getting them trained. Yeah. You're losing money, okay? And that was staggering in and of itself, Robert. But when I really dove into it, what I found is a significant percentage of those that do leave in the first 100 days. So what are you doing in that first 100-day time period to make the experience remarkable? What are you doing to onboarding them? What are you doing to get them to pay attention? Because when we really looked at it, more than half of the people who were going to leave left before the 100-day anniversary. So I'm not saying you shouldn't pay attention to the entire life cycle of everybody on your team. What I am saying is those first few weeks and months are a foundational period that if we don't establish the connection and establish the relationship early on, any hope of keeping them long term is completely lost.
And look, I think back to Zappos, I think there's some actually, I'd say the opposite is true. There's some good outcomes where if it's not going to work out, actually, you probably do want to pull the cord quickly. But
100%.
I actually think that both sides make quick judgments, right? And if you start in a negative cycle, if someone does, we have found generally someone did really poorly in our business in the first couple of weeks and almost never worked out. And you could study all kinds of things you want to study about why we did that at a training or otherwise. But the reality was it was probably a deficit and then a trust thing and then a vicious spiral. So the reality was true, even if you wanted to come up with a whole bunch of hypotheses of why that shouldn't be the case, that after 2 weeks, I could decide with pretty high probability whether you would be here in a year. So, you know,
it happens even faster than that.
Yeah.
The research actually shows that 74% of employees decide whether they'll stay for a month based on their experience the first day. 74%. And to your point, a lot of employers know early on, this isn't going to be a good fit. So I try to always get curious before I get critical, Robert. I try to figure out, like, before I start saying, oh, well, that's because you had poor onboarding or terrible interviews or, you know, the market, kids these days, they just don't want to work. Whatever knee-jerk reaction we want to have, pump the brakes just a second and instead get curious and say, well, why is this?
Yeah.
Is it because we're hiring too fast? Is it because we're not clearly setting expectations with the job description? Is it because we're trying to bait and switch for the role we hire for versus the task we actually want them to do? Is it because we're in a scenario where we are hemorrhaging internally, that there is such a desire to just get any warm body into the seat that will lower our standards and accept anyone? Is it because we don't have an onboarding process? Instead, we have orientation. One of the first things I ask clients is when we start working together in a consulting capacity is, how long is your training process, your orientation process, your onboarding process for new employees? And the average answer I get is either 2 or 3 days. Now, here's the crazy thing. If you want someone to stay for years, you got to be willing to spend more than 2 to 3 days getting them up to speed.
I have always found, and I think when we were remote, we had to be intentional about this. I always said this, like the best companies, you pretty much showed up. I remember working with one of them and you didn't hit your desk for 3 weeks. You were going here for 4 days, here for 4 days, you were doing this and you were coming back and you're also always usually getting on the front lines of customer service or something else. It was weeks before you even started your real job. And I always felt that was best practice. And I always said as a remote company, we were kind of forced. It was too awkward to come to work and stare at a screen. So we were actually forced to like be like those companies and give you structured stuff to do for 2 weeks because all my experiences, a lot of them early on were onboarding, were like, come in, hey, follow, shadow Joey. We actually couldn't do that as a remote company. So we had to be better, which I actually thought gave us an advantage. But shadow, just follow Joey around. I mean, it's great to follow Joey around, but that's not real onboarding.
No, it's not. And here's the thing. I'm not opposed to shadowing and on-the-job training and all of those things. There's a lot of great data that shows those work incredibly well. I'm opposed to thinking any one solution is right. The panacea for all your problems. That's different employees in different roles need different levels of handholding and different levels of teaching. I think most businesses are trying to train their employees instead of teach their employees. And the nuance that I'm referring to in the specific choice of words there is, training to me is saying, I want you to do it this way. Teaching is saying, you should do it this way because if you don't, here are the consequences that happen. Oh, and by the way, we tried this other way that you just thought of and we're like, why don't they do it this way? Let me tell you about when we did it that way. And here's how it blew up in our face. And here's what years of practice. And by the way, if you have a better way of doing it, we're open to that. Come to us. But you can't come to us with a new idea until you've done this idea for 2 weeks. Because you'll figure out whether it's actually a good idea or not. And I say this respectively because it drives me crazy when organizations are pejorative of their new hires and they're like, oh, they're new. They don't know anything. They're newbies, they're kids, whatever it may be.
Yeah. Sometimes that's super helpful, but clean slate. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think those type of employees are the ones that we should embrace because they're not jaded. They don't have the old baggage. Ritz-Carlton does something amazing on day 21. So your 21st day on the job, your 3-week anniversary. They bring you in for a meeting with the head of your manager and the head of that property and all the division heads of that particular hotel or resort location you're working at. And they bring you together for a 45-minute meeting and they say, so you've been here for 3 weeks. What are we doing wrong? What are we doing that we could be doing better? What are we doing that you don't understand why we do it? And then they're quiet and they let this employee talk and they get fresh eyes and fresh perspective. And they see where the holes are in their onboarding process and their training processes. And I think that type of curiosity with new hires will serve any organization well.
Yeah, it's a version of start, stop, continue, which I always think 100%. You learn a ton of. But I want to go back to something people might have missed that you said, because this is a book about how to never lose an employee again. And you're really focused on the onboarding and you have this 8-phase framework. But the first 2 phases are about getting the right people under the right context. Right. The assumption is you cannot fix what's broken coming in, right? Which is interesting because it implies that, you know, again, I people call me in the past. They're like, let me ask you something. We're doing a JD for a sales and marketing person. I was like, oh, you know, like sales is going to want something different than marketing. This like it's just set up for everyone to be disappointed from the beginning, no matter how well you did the onboarding. So I don't want people to miss sort of that you said that. Take us through the 8 A's that you've laid out in the framework.
Absolutely. So there are 8 phases to the employee journey, and I believe we can break them into categorizations that allow each of these phases to start with the letter A. And the reason for that is not to confuse folks, but rather to say, if you get all of these phases right, it's like getting straight A's on your report card from your employees. They think you're doing a great job. So the first phase is the assess phase. This is when a prospective employee is trying to decide whether or not they even want to work with you. They're checking out the job description or the one ad. They're going to the About Us page or the Careers page on your website to see what's going on. They're probably going on LinkedIn or some other social media tool and seeing who do they know that also works at your organization or used to work at your organization. They're figuring it out. Yeah. They're also going through your hiring process. So submitting an application or a resume, going through interviews. This is the courting. And what most organizations don't realize is that this is the opportunity to preview what the experience of actually being an employee is going to be like, and to start to show your brand and figure out ways to see their brand, see who they are, instead of did they have rote answers to these 3 questions we ask every candidate. We then come to the accept phase. The accept phase has 2 component parts. We decide as the employer, this is the candidate we want to extend an offer to. And if we're lucky, that candidate accepts our offer.
I think it's really important in that phase that the employee doesn't morph themselves to be what they think the employer wants, and the employer doesn't try to be everything to everyone too. Like that's where a lot of things go wrong, where I would say like, it's not a good or bad, but like, if we're a passing team, like let's not talk about running to convince the person that you know they're a running back and that we really like we're going to throw the ball, like, you know. So I see a lot of problems happen because both sides are trying to be a little chameleon to the other.
Robert, 100%. We see this in dating all the time. I heard somebody describe one time, and I think it was a comedian. He was like, yeah, the first 5 dates are about how well can I lie to get to the next date, right? And but it sounds facetious and ridiculous, but this is how most organizations behave. I was on a dating app years ago before I met my amazing wife, and I wrote on the app, I'm not really that into sports unless it's the Olympics or Notre Dame football. If you have pets, I wish you the best with that. I'm not a pets guy. But what I am into is, and then I listed some things. And the number of people that reached out and said, hey, you're not a good fit for me, but thanks for being clear.
Right. Thanks for saving me 3 useless dates.
Dates in the head. And I think as employers, we should do that. I think when we think of a job description, it should be more about what we're going to do as the employer than what we expect you to do as an employee. Hey, as your employer, we're going to expect you to show up at these particular times, but we're going to be ready for you and we're going to train you and we're going to do this. And here's what a day in the life. What I don't understand is why every employer on the planet doesn't on their website list out every job at their company and have almost a diary entry of a day in the life of that job.
Right. Why are you trying to dress it up? We always give people, we do, our interviews were always half culture and half fit for the job. And the job always required some homework that frankly wasn't valuable to us, but mimicked what you're actually going to have to do. And so when people were arguing, they're like, I don't process information quickly, or I don't do the, like, look, this is the exact, you're not going to like the job, right?
Exactly. We're giving you a preview of what the experience of being here is actually going to be like. And that's where I think our whole interview process needs to shift from this, come to this room or come to this Zoom call, and I'm going to ask you some rote questions that you've been asked in every interview that I don't even know what to do with the answers you give me. Yeah. I don't really learn anything about you. And instead, moving towards what I'm seeing a lot of the smartest businesses do, which this has been around for a while, but it surprises me how few companies do it. Hire them for a test project. Say, hey, great, we're down to four candidates. We're going to hire all of you for 2 weeks. And here's what the job is. Go do this and give them a substantive, meaningful task.
And pay, you're saying pay them.
Pay
too.
For it. Yeah, pay them. Yeah, this isn't a spec work volunteer BS. No, pay them to do the job. And then when they submit the work, less than looking at the work and saying, oh, did they check all the lists? Get creative with them. Sit down and say, great, so here are the answers you gave us. How did you do this? How did you come across these? What made you distill your research down to these findings or these recommendations? And you'll get a chance to see what it's like to actually work with them and get the feel for them. The other thing I'll say is stop having interviews in conference rooms or only over Zoom. I understand during the pandemic, there wasn't an opportunity for in person, but go out to a bar. Go to a restaurant, go golfing, go axe throwing, go for a walk. I don't care what you do, but get into an environment that is more akin to the environment that coworkers have, which is, hey, we're in the same space, working on the same project together. Let's see how it goes.
Yeah, it seems some of this stuff seems common sense is not so common, right? In terms of doing this. We always gave people a project, but I know that then there was all this criticism of companies getting free. But we make it clear that it had zero actual value to the business, but it was a task or a presentation you had to come in. It just looked like something you would have to do. But we tried to make it clear, like, this isn't real. It has no value, but we need to see how you would do the actual work. Jeff Smart's very big on, and I love the thing, like, by month 12, here is what the expectations are. This is basically success or failure. This is firing or promotion. So if you don't want to build a $2 million book of business with 100 people in the pipeline by month 12, then your first performance review is going to be, you know, that's the first performance review. Why we sit in the room and we love you or we don't love you.
Yes, absolutely. And I think this can be part of every conversation with a new employee. You go to them maybe 3 or 4 weeks into the job and you say, great, at this point, we've learned a little bit about you. You've learned a little bit about us.
Yeah.
Let me show you the three paths that are available to you going forward. One is to stay in this position. You can continue to double down on your skills here. The next is if you think you might like to be a manager in this department someday, we're going to start to move you into that track. If you think there's a different division of the company that this division is the wrong place for you to be, let's get you some exposure over there. Investing in the employee to help build their career and help them think through their career path not only serves them, but it serves your organization because now we're making sure we have the right people in the right positions. And instead of waiting for an annual review 12 months later, we're having that conversation at the 30-day mark, at the 60-day mark. Don't have it on day two, right? Let them get a little bit, you know, of the feet wet.
Or really have it before you start.
Right. Ideally, even before you start, show them the way.
So I can't remember because they're all A. I can't remember how many.
That's all good. So we did the first two. So the assess phase and the accept phase. We then come to phase three, the affirm phase. Okay. Most folks listening are familiar with the concept of buyer's remorse, where we begin to doubt a purchase we just made. There is a parallel in the world of employee experience called new hire's remorse. This is where a new hire begins to doubt the decision they made to accept your job offer minutes after the ink is dry on their acceptance. I mean, it happens almost immediately. Brain science shows us that this happens. The problem is in most organizations, Robert, there is no communication or very little communication with the new hire between when they accept the offer and their first day on the job. And in this stage, the affirm stage, what you need to be doing is affirming their choice, letting them know that you are thrilled, excited, that they said yes.
This is the confirmation bias stage.
This is the confirmation bias. Exactly. This is like, you got to let them know, hey, you made the right choice. We're going to take great care of you. We then come to phase four, the activate phase. This is the first official day on the job. Okay. The first day of work. Now, what's interesting is this isn't day one of the 100 days. Day one is when they accept the job offer. So they might be showing up at work 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month after they accepted the job offer. The secret on this day is to remember the immortal words of country music legend Bonnie Raitt and give them something to talk about. You got to give them something to talk about on that first day. Why? Because we know, because we've done this ourselves, when they get home that night to their spouse, their roommate, their kids, their parents, whoever it is they live with, or they're driving home or they're commuting home and they're on the phone with their loved ones, what is the first question those loved ones are going to ask? How was your first day at work?
Same thing you ask your kid first day of kindergarten.
Same thing you ask your kid in the first day of school. How was it?
Yeah.
You want to prime them with the stories to tell. You want to have given them such a remarkable experience that they're like, oh my gosh, I think I may be working at the place where I work for the rest of my career. What would the standard be for your first day agenda planning of new hire onboarding and training if the standard was, I want them to tell their loved one that later that night, this is the place where I think I'm going to spend the rest of my career? Kind of changes the game. We then come to the acclimate phase. Now, I will tell you, Robert, the acclimate phase is where most organizations fall apart, and it's where most employees leave. The acclimate phase is from the second day on the job, and it lasts weeks, sometimes even months, depending on the job. What's fascinating to me is I talk to HR leaders around the world, and I say, who's responsible for the day one experience? And most of them have an answer. Oh, I am. I'm the head of HR. Or, oh, this talent manager. Who's responsible for day two and day five and day seven and day 13 and day 22? And I watch as their faces just kind of lose all the color. And they say, their manager, I suppose. Someone who, by the way, often was promoted because they were good at the job, not at managing people, and is now responsible for onboarding this new employee and making sure that they have a great experience here. What are we doing to hold their hand and help them acclimate as they navigate their first few weeks and months on the job?
Yeah, I without a central owner, I'm assuming you have there's no quality control in terms of boss A is really good at this, manager B is not good at this, and people have super varied experiences.
Unbelievably varied experiences, let alone I could sit down with a room of managers right now and say, if you have a new member join your team, what do they need to be able to do by day 21? And you'll be met with stunned silence.
Yeah, or different answers. Yeah.
Number one, either stunned silence because they've never even considered that question before. Yeah. Or number two, to your point, wildly varied answers that show even the people who've been here for years can't agree what we should be able to do by day 21 on the job. So we've got to do better at this. We then come to phase six, the accomplish phase. This is when the employee achieves the goal they had when they originally decided to accept the job offer. And pro tip to everyone out there listening, the thing they're hoping to achieve is not a paycheck every 2 weeks, okay? Those are the ante up chips to sit down at the table. They want to be paid, don't get me wrong, and you got to pay them well. But every employee has a vision of what life will be when they accept your offer. More responsibility, better opportunities, greater opportunities for growth and learning. Maybe they'll be able to travel. Maybe they'll have an assistant. Maybe they'll be able to work outside. I don't care what the thing is, but they have a vision of what they're trying to accomplish. The question for leaders is, do you know what your employees are trying to accomplish? And are you helping track their progress towards that, calling out milestone accomplishments along the way to celebrate and acknowledge? Most organizations aren't. We then come to the last two phases, the adopt phase, phase seven. This is when the employee becomes loyal to you and only you. Robert, here's the kicker. Most organizations today have adopters that are working within their enterprise that they are woefully taking for granted. They have not given the type of support and acknowledgement and accolades and care and personal and emotional connection to these team players who have been there, who have contributed, who are amazing. And here's where it gets scary. That person walks into your office and says, you know what? I need to go. And our thought as a leader is, I need to do everything in my power to keep them, because if this person leaves, they're a cornerstone. Everything falls apart. If you're having that thought about your adopters, when they give notice, you're several years too late to have started thinking about that. Last but not least, we come to the advocate phase. This is where your employees become your raving fans, singing your praises far and wide. Two interesting things here. Number one, I talk to many companies who they say, oh, Joey, we've got great advocates. And I'm like, oh, brilliant. Let's put that to the test. Do you have any current open job positions? And lots of times they're like, oh, yeah, we're hiring for a new receptionist. I'm like, great. Of the candidates you're considering, how many are direct referrals from your existing employees? None. Then guess what, friends? You don't actually have advocates.
In the net promoter world, this is, are you referring people? Yeah.
This is real basic. If you have a remarkable place to work, your team members are going to be pulling everyone they know to come join them at work. Their best friends, the smartest people they know, loved ones. And somebody asked me recently, they were like, Joey, I've got a star player, an absolutely remarkable sales leader. He's incredible. And he just referred his sister for an open position. Do you think we should interview her? And I said, let's deconstruct this scenario a little bit.
First, let's look at your nepotism policy.
First of all, let's look at your nepotism policy. But second of all, let's look at what's going on here and say, I have two sisters and four brothers. I'm one of seven kids. If I'm going to refer one of my siblings to come be an employee where I work, you can bet I'm only referring the best ones, because this is where I am. I don't want to run the risk that my reputation gets sullied, that my performance gets, you know, dinged because of a bad referral I made. Most people, if they're referring someone, that's someone that absolutely requires an extra look at you. And the last thing I'll say about advocates is advocates don't have to be current employees.
Yeah.
There's a case study in the book. There are over 50 case studies in the book. And one of them is from McKinsey & Company. And the leader of McKinsey has this great line. He says, we take great pride in the fact that there's a little bit of McKinsey in a lot of different places. If you have employees who have left and you haven't burned the bridge, if they are out in the world, in the marketplace, singing your praises, referring you business, referring you employees, that's the sign of a remarkable employer, not somebody who's like, oh, well, they said they were leaving to go somewhere else, so they're dead to me. No, yeah. If they were good enough to be part of your team and you loved having them there, don't be irritated that they left. Keep that connection, keep that relationship, because in some instances, it may turn into a boomerang employee who comes back to work for you with more insight, more perspective than they had before. But at the very least, they become a beacon of advocacy, singing your praises.
And look, this is an amazing framework, but to our earlier discussion, and I encourage people to get in the book, because as Joey says, he has case studies and things you can do otherwise. You just have to be careful not to overprocess, because I think there's a lot of moments and sort of individual showing up for people here. I think the perfect example, can you share the voicemail story kind of again? Because this isn't something that's going to be in a process manual. This is something that like a person has to do.
And are you referring to the voicemail that I received?
The CEB one, yeah.
The CEB one, yeah, yeah. So, because voicemails can be used in a lot of powerful ways. So I was working for a company called the Corporate Executive Board, CEB, and I was in a sales capacity. And I made my first sale. And what was great is, this is back in the early 2000s. We were in the office. We had a whole floor of salespeople. My manager threw an impromptu happy hour. Everybody was celebrating. They were ringing bells. Oh, Joey got his first sale. This is super exciting. After happy hour that night, you know, the lights were down, the sun had set. I went back to my desk to pack up and head home. And there was a little light blinking on my desk phone. You know, I'm dating myself here, but this is
back in the days. You might have to explain to some people what a desk phone is.
Yeah. For all you people listening, there used to be phones sitting on your desk and it had a light, kind of like what you see in a hotel. And when the light's blinking, that means you have a message. It was like that. And so I go to play the voicemail. And the voicemail is from the chairman of the board. Corporate Executive Board was a publicly traded company at that time. The message is from the chairman of the board. And he says, "Hey, Joey, I know we haven't had the chance to meet in person yet, but I heard that earlier today you closed your first sale with Acme Corp." But he said the actual name of the company. Yeah. He said, "I got to tell you, we're so proud of you. This is amazing."
By the way, this is before like Salesforce alerts and like, this is 100%. When this is when this information was probably harder to get.
Yeah. This is when what happened is someone on the team messaged the chairman and said, "We have an employee that just had a big accomplishment today. We need to acknowledge that." And that chairman had made it clear to the folks on the team, "I want to be part of celebrating these milestone moments." Robert, he left this message, and I'm standing there in my cubicle at the beginning of my career with this company, and I'm thinking, I matter. Someone's noticed me. I'm an up-and-comer. The chairman of the board of a publicly traded company knows who I am. Now, on one hand, I'm not proud that my ego was so excited that day, but on the other hand, I'm human, and this is how humans operate. In fact, I actually transferred that recording onto a little dictaphone. Now I'm really dating myself. There used to be these little tape machines we held, and I actually transferred it onto that, played it on speaker so I could hear it. And then when I was out on the road doing sales and I had a deal that I didn't close, or I was having a particularly bad day, or my flight had been delayed 8 hours and I wasn't going to get home, I would play that recording as a little pick-me-up, as a little reminder that I had what it took, that it was going to be okay, that people believed in me. When you do these type of things for your people, when you give them mementos, artifacts, tangible proof that they matter, the investment of time you have to spend in it is a fraction of the return on investment and the value it will have, not only for that individual, but for your organization.
All right, Joe, we could talk about this forever. Last question, which will be a complicated one, so you might even pick it apart. But again, we're in this weird period right now. We're still coming out of COVID. It's been supply, demand, too many employees, not enough employees. I'm curious of when the dust settles, sort of what you think steady state is going to look like for a high performance organization. And considering the lens of this, I think there's two paths an organization can pick these days. You can pick free agent nation, where everything's for rent and a bunch of mercenaries, and you can get a whole bunch of mercenaries to come do projects for your company and outsource everything. But I think it can't be half pregnant, right? You either have a sort of, not saying on outsourcing, you either have a company and a team and a mission that people kind of sign up for to be part of, or they come to deliver some specific value to you. So what, not for the former, but what do you think for the latter? Like, what is it going to look like to have, you know, a really successful organization when we kind of get to the, whatever the new normal looks like?
Well, in the same way that I think most organizations are alighting on the new normal being defined by the phrase hybrid, where it's a combination of in-person and remote work.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be hybrid between that mercenaries and missionaries, you know, kind of definition or categorization of team members. I am not a huge sports person, but one of the ways that I am increasingly thinking that organizations should be looking at their teams and their talent is the way a college coach would. Now, here's the interesting thing about college coaches. They're trying to convince people who don't have as much experience that they should trust to come to their organization where they will be groomed and taken care of and trained and prepped for the next thing in their life. And any college coach knows when a player comes that at most they're going to be there 6 years. And if they're really good, probably three. Or one. And then what are they going to do? They're going to go off to other places. Now, if you know that they're only going to be there for a short period of time, and you know they're going to leave and go elsewhere, your goals become very different. Your goal becomes to, what can we do to work as cohesively and collectively as possible during this time we have together to take advantage of the talents we have, to build on the skill sets we have, to double down on that in a really intense and focused way? And what can we do to create such personal and emotional connection that when you leave, you'll want to come back? And the reason this is powerful, at least in the college sports world, is when the alumni come back, they then become the recruiters for the future people coming in, because somebody looks at them and says, I want that life. And that person is there as part of the recruiting effort. So I think the best companies in the world are going to be flexible. They're going to be adaptable. They're going to be hybrid. And they're going to stop thinking, oh, I need to hire this person and have them be here for the next 30 years. And instead say, I am honored to play a role in a chapter in their life. How can we co-create this chapter in such a beautiful way that they see it as one of the greatest places they've ever worked and tell everyone they know that?
That's a good answer. I think people should listen closely to that. I know a lot of people don't like sports analogies, but they're really good in a lot of contexts.
Well, and I think I don't disagree. And what I will say is another one that I pulled is I think the operative word that at least I use, and I think is a really solid word to use for the people that are part of your organization, is your team.
Yeah.
Because
it's not a family.
It's not a family.
I would say family is where you tolerate the drunk uncle who does inappropriate things at the wedding, right? That's not what a business world is. It's a high functioning team. And I think in a team, you understand that if you're putting up bricks over and over and over again, you're going to sit on the bench. You're hurting the team.
Absolutely.
There's just some realities that don't exist in the family.
100%. Teams also know we're playing a game. We take it seriously, but not too seriously. But we are keeping score. And there are rules and there are consequences to breaking the rules. If we break the rules, we don't score. We get kicked out. We're competing again and again. We have an on season and an off season. We have a time where we're training and we have a time when we're executing. Yeah. There's so many things built into this understanding.
And it's not about me, me, me. It's not about self-optimization. I think I talk a lot about this woman at a conference that I think what people are going to want is to work when they want, how they want, and what they want. I'm like, well, then you're going to have to be part of that mercenary group. Because being part of a team, to your example, no one goes into a college sports program and existing, pick any of them, Alabama or whatever, said, look, I got my own style, my own way of doing things here. Like I've got to, you know, I think Jack Stack said that once. Like, you just don't do that. To be part of a team requires sacrifices. And I think that's the part people have lost. If you want to go work for a mercenary army, there are trade-offs for that. If you want to work for a team, there's different trade-offs, but it doesn't mean about always what's best for you.
100%. And I think to that point, most people have no problem with rules, have no problem with standards. It's that we're not clearly expressing them, or we're coming into a performance review 12 months later and saying, well, you didn't live up to this. And I've been in those reviews where I'm like, you never said that was a criteria. This wasn't part of the job description, any of the training. And now you're telling me that what really mattered was X, Y, Z. That shows a lack of care, a lack of consideration, a lack of structure, a lack of planning, a lack of organization. I mean, this is just not the kind of place you want to work. So it's kind of good that I didn't live up to that standard, because this is a hot mess. There's definitely room for improvement for all of us.
All right, Joey, where can people learn about your work, consulting, speaking, the new book?
So the new book is called Never Lose an Employee Again. It's available wherever you like to find your books. So the small indie bookstore, the big box store, online, offline, whatever works for you. I also like to share with folks, it's available in whatever format of books you like. If you're a hardcover person, you want to take notes in the margins, you're good to go. If you like to highlight it in your Kindle or Nook, you're all set. And if you've enjoyed or tolerated my voice as we talk today, there's an audiobook that I narrate. The best place to find me online is my website, joeycoleman.com. That's J-O-E-Y, like a five-year-old you might know, or a baby kangaroo. Coleman, C-O-L-E-M-A-N, like the camping equipment, but no relation. Joeycoleman.com. You can find out more about how to never lose an employee or never lose a customer. If there's anything I can do to be of support as you navigate the journey of creating remarkable experiences for the folks you interact with, please don't hesitate to reach out. And I just got to say again, Robert, I am thrilled and honored to be a three-peater here on the podcast. It was an absolute delight joining you. And thanks to everybody for listening in.
Well, Joey, thanks for joining us again. Happy to have you kick off the three-peat club. And we'll have you back when you do the Never Lose a Partner book again. All right, to our listeners, thanks for tuning into the Elevate podcast today. We'll include links to Joey and Never Lose an Employee Again on the detailed episode page at robertglaser.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure to follow the show to be notified about new episodes and have them downloaded to listen automatically. If you're listening in Apple Podcasts, simply hit follow on the show overview page or the three little dots in the upper right corner if you're on an individual episode page in the app, and then you can hit follow. You can also hit follow on CastBox, Spotify, Pandora, or your favorite podcast player. Thanks again for your support. Until next time, keep elevating.
This episode is brought to you by the Yap Media Podcast Network. I'm Hala Taha, CEO of the award-winning digital media empire, Yap Media, and host of Yap Young and Profiting Podcast, a number one entrepreneurship and self-improvement podcast where you can listen, learn, and profit. On Young and Profiting Podcast, I interview the brightest minds in the world, and I turn their wisdom into actionable advice that you can use in your daily life. Each week, we dive into a new topic like the art of side hustles, how to level up your influence and persuasion, and goal setting. I interview A-list guests on Young and Profiting. I've got the best guests, like the world's number one negotiation expert, Chris Voss, Shark Damon John, serial entrepreneurs Alex and Layla Hormozi, and even movie stars like Matthew McConaughey. There's absolutely no fluff on my podcast, and that's on purpose. Every episode is jam-packed with advice that's going to push your life forward. I do my research, I get straight to the point, and I take things really seriously, which is why I'm known as the podcast princess and how I became one of the top podcasters in the world in less than 5 years. Young and Profiting Podcast is for all ages. Don't let the name fool you. It's an advanced show. As long as you want to learn and level up, you will be forever young. So join podcast royalty and subscribe to Young and Profiting Podcast, or Yap, like it's often called by my Yap fam, on Apple, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.